Welcome to today's issue of Medical Progress Today. Our guest on today's podcast is Ralph Hall. Ralph Hall is counsel to the Indianapolis, Indiana law firm of Baker & Daniels, where he counsels clients in the area of drug and device regulation. He also serves as CEO of MR3 Medical, a startup medical device company. Ralph is also professor of practice at the University of Minnesota Law School. Ralph, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ralph, I think that it's fair to say that medical device regulation and the medical device industry's relationship with the FDA has become a very hot topic in recent months, at least over the last year, because the industry has been very vocal about concerns that the FDA, as its regulator, has become unpredictable, extraordinarily costly in terms of the time that it takes for new products to get through the agency's pre-market approval process. And then finally, that companies are finding it increasingly more advantageous to go to Europe or go to Asia, either to get regulatory approval first or to just get first revenues from those countries. Could you give me an overview of what the challenges, concerns are of the medical device industry and what kind of issues they're facing with the FDA today?
As you think about it, Paul, there are probably five major challenges that the industry perceives and is trying to address at this point in time. These include a lack of predictability in the system, including the timing requirements, and related to that, unclear and changing requirements, particularly midstream. Industry has concerns about timeliness of the review process, and it's important to note that this includes both the pre-market activities, particularly IDE review and approvals, as well as the marketing application process, the 510K and PMA processes. There is concern that there is excessive non-value-added regulatory activity, including questions from reviewers, and the need for process and resource utilization improvements. Those are, at a high level, the major challenges that industry is expressing and that Congress is attempting to address.
And this is a particular concern because, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, I think, medical devices and drugs are one of those few areas in the economy where the manufacturer has to get approval to market a product before they can sell it. And that means that you could place potentially hundreds of millions of dollars, at least in the case of drugs, let's say tens of millions of dollars, potentially hundreds of millions of dollars for device, into the research and design of a product that then is never allowed for sale. So in a sense, you're flushing that money down the toilet, and that's the concern there.
It's a serious concern. You're absolutely correct that the majority of products that the American consumer has access to do not go through a pre-market approval process, clothing, toys, et cetera. And drugs, devices, and biologics are some of the exceptions that in most cases do require some pre-market review by FDA. And the research behind these products is often very extensive and very expensive, and particularly for small startup companies, the time frame to market and the predictability of that is critical in raising capital to finance those activities. And it's important as part of that to recognize that a significant number of medical technology innovations come from small startup companies.
And to put that in another way, assuming you're a small startup and you go through your first round of, venture capital or angel investing, you're going to burn through that money pretty quickly, given, as you said, these are very sophisticated products here. You could potentially spend millions of dollars very, very quickly. And if you don't have a certain path to market, you may not get that additional round of financing, or you may just run out of money and go bankrupt. And that's the problem there, not having a clear, predictable regulatory path to approval.
Correct. And as you can well recognize, venture capital, angel financers, or other financing sources are looking at predictability. And they have the opportunity to make investments in a number of technologies, green energy, for example, or wireless technology, software, et cetera, which do not have the same pre-market requirements.
Right. So you could go to the next, Facebook, just to pick a name, or the next Apple and say, well, why don't I invest in that technology versus this if the path to market is so uncertain and expensive?
As you think about it from the VC perspective, they are accepting the technology and market risk. But on top of that, you then have the regulatory challenge that is fairly unique to the drug and device world. And that increases the cost of capital and decreases the willingness of many venture capital firms to invest in this area.
So recently, and I think this is a nice segue, recently Republicans on the Energy and Commerce Committee issued a list of pieces of legislation, I think something like 10 in all, that deal with various aspects of the regulatory environment. And this is not to endorse any particular piece of those legislation, but I think all of them attempt to address some of the issues that you just outlined in terms of the predictability of the regulatory review process, the timeliness, the kinds of information that's requested from reviewers, and whether or not the information and the processes actually add value to the final product. So let's go through a few of these pieces of legislation just to talk about, you know, some of the key issues they address and whether or not they're really adding value, you know, from their perspective or improving the process. Could you give us kind of a high-level overview of what the legislation is trying to do?
Of course. It's first important to note that the various pieces of legislation are not a radical redo of the medical device regulatory system. These are efforts to improve the system, to address the issues of predictability, timeliness, changing requirements, et cetera. You may remember the recent Institute of Medicine report on the 510K system that advocated eliminating the system and replacing it with something totally different. This is not that type of radical approach. These are efforts to improve, not to start again.
And with that vision of these are really incremental, valuable, but still incremental changes, I think. Let's talk about the first piece I looked at, the Pre-Market Predictability Act. And I think just picking up on what you just said, it seems that, tell me where I'm wrong here, but it seems like this is a fairly common sense piece of legislation, which I think is just trying to clarify the FDA already has the ability to utilize, quote unquote, least burdensome requirements from sponsors. And that means least burdensome types of clinical trials, number of patients enrolled. Can you use surrogate endpoints in those trials? Versus, you know, final endpoints like death or something like that. Can you use other endpoints? By surrogate, they typically mean something like, you know, at least in the drug space, like cholesterol, to determine the safety and effectiveness of a new medical device. Am I reading the bill correctly? And if that's true, why isn't the FDA utilizing that flexibility they've got right now?
Least burdensome concepts were first introduced by the legislature in 1997. This bill is an effort to reinforce the importance of the least burdensome concept and to ensure that the FDA understands the importance of this to Congress and to the broad med tech community. As you think about least burdensome, it's important to understand that the least burdensome concept is not an effort to reduce the regulatory requirements, to make them, you know, somehow different. Rather, it addresses how one meets those regulatory requirements. And the concept is, to meet that requirement, there may be two or three ways to do it. Let's pick the way that imposes the least burden on all participants, industry, FDA reviewers, et cetera.
How do you go about, and I know this is a constant question when I think about the FDA, how do you go about creating metrics that are transparent to policymakers, that are transparent to the companies that have to go through this process? You summarized it very effectively, what least burdensome means. But would that mean that the FDA should put out, say, a menu of options and then say, well, here are the ways we think you could go about this, and here's one that's very expensive and time-consuming, but here we think is one that meets the same endpoints and is still, you know, proves that the product is safe and effective, but it's clearly less expensive and less time-consuming. How do you create a framework where that is not just, you know, a statutory requirement, but actually is visible to the people who are going through the process and allows us to evaluate whether or not the FDA is actually using that approach?
There are two ways you can attempt to implement this. One way is with broad guidance documents which lay out for a particular question or a particular class of products approaches to satisfy the particular regulatory requirements that apply to that. These are not binding, but they are very instructive. And if you apply least burdensome to the development of those guidance documents, that gives industry and other stakeholders a lot of insight into the agency thinking on how to achieve that.
That's a terrific point. Let's circle back to that a little bit later, because I'm curious about how good the FDA has been about creating helpful guidance documents and how much input experts, stakeholders in academia and elsewhere have had into those documents so that when they finally come out, they're the product of a consensus process rather than just an internal process at the FDA that may or may not reflect what really best practice might be from, say, an outside point of view. But another element I saw in this legislation that was interesting, tell me if this is really important, legislation was mandating the FDA attach a tracking number to every application And also, and I thought this was very interesting, attach an explanation for any major regulatory decision attached to the regulatory decision for an application for a particular device. That seems to be a good business practice. I wonder if that would not also benefit the agency, because if a sponsor happened to complain about something, the agency could then point to the record and say, here, this is why we made our decision. If you think we're wrong, you can explain why we're wrong. But it would give a clarity and transparency. What do you think about that? Is that something that would really be helpful?
I think it's helpful in a number of respects. First of all, tracking time and submission is an excellent way to assess metrics and performance and changes in performance over time. Secondly, as you pointed out, this includes requirements for explanation for decisions that the sponsor can then assess and decide next steps. And that's helpful in a couple of ways and actually links into another part of the bill. If I know why the agency made a decision, I can address that clearly in my next interaction with the agency on this submission. But it also guides me in my future interactions with the agency, because now I have a better understanding of their requirements and their thought process.
Or say you're another small company and you've got a similar product, or at least in the same class of products, you can look at what the agency did in this particular class, see why they made a certain decision, and get some certainty that if you take a similar path, you should meet a similar outcome.
Correct. That's also part of the concept of this greater transparency. And currently, the agency has a number of transparency initiatives that, when fully implemented, should help, you know, the next applicant understand the ground rules and have a level playing field.
That's great. Another piece of legislation, this is also a very short piece of legislation. It's only about, I think, 3 or 4 pages long, the Novel Device Regulatory Review Act. I don't follow devices very closely. Could you explain what the de novo review process is for medical devices, and then also why this bill allows people to, I guess, effectively declare that they're going to go right into the de novo regulatory review process?
The de novo process has been around for a number of years, but I think all stakeholders, FDA, industry, and others, have recognized that it hasn't been administratively effective. And what de novo is a pathway by which one who has developed an innovative new device, which does not have a predicate and therefore is not eligible for the 510K system, can utilize the 510K system once a risk-based assessment is done that the 510K system provides adequate protections for safety and effectiveness. And what this bill does is to make that pathway more predictable and user-friendly. In the past, you actually had to go through the 510K system, get an explicit determination by the agency that you weren't eligible because you had no predicate, and then start your de novo process. What this says is that if I'm the company and I know I don't have a predicate, I can avoid putting the agency and myself through that time and effort and go to the agency and say, I don't think I have a predicate, but I think from a risk assessment, the 510K system is the best one. Assess me via the de novo and make the classification decision. There's an important point here, Paul, and that is de novo is not an approval decision. It's a classification decision. Which pathway, 510K or PMA?
So, and then just to clarify for readers who may not be very familiar, as I am not, with this process. So in the 510K process, basically that's a low-risk medical device, a relatively low-risk medical device. To go through the 510K, typically a sponsor would have to point to another device that was a marketed, approved device that is similar to the one that would go through the 510K process and said, this device is my predicate. I believe I should go through the 510K process, both because of the risk associated with the device, but also because there's a predicate that can follow it. The de novo process is for people who say, well, I've got a low-risk device, but there isn't a predicate, and that would seem to be good, because if you bring something novel to market, there's no other product out there like it, you'd want to encourage an appropriate review for that product, because it might be a groundbreaking product.
Correct. And not all innovative new products require the same type or level of regulation. And the de novo system allows the agency to make a risk-based classification decision to assess whether this new technology is best regulated under the PMA pathway or under the 510K pathway for kind of medium-risk devices.
And the PMA pathway typically requires clinical trials. Is that a fair summation of what the PMA process requires?
It does. It's a longer, more arduous process, both for industry and for FDA.
Right. we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. Finally, we'll wrap up this section of our conversation and then move on to part two and talk about some other issues for our next edition. But so we were talking about both these cases, pre-market review of products. One thing I was curious to read in another one of the bills was a program that they wanted to clarify and I think improve for third-party reviewers to review products or help, I guess, the FDA review products. It strikes me that there is a parallel to this outside of the FDA. It's Underwriters Laboratories, which also reviews products for consumer products for safety. It's a private firm, not-for-profit firm, but also reviews products for safety and safe use before they're sold. From my understanding of the bill, the FDA can also use these outside reviewers to evaluate products, perhaps similar to the way that Underwriters Laboratory operates. Could you explain for us this process? Do I have the right analogy? And how would this bill affect the status quo?
There's a number of similarities between the processes you've described. What Congress established a number of years ago is for lower-risk 510K devices, the agency could essentially outsource the initial review of that product to accredited third parties. These are people with the right expertise, without conflicts of interest, et cetera. And those people who are paid by industry, not by FDA, will do a review of the product and then make a recommendation to the agency as to whether the product should or should not be cleared. The final decision remains FDA's, but this is a way to have outside firms do a lot of the day-to-day work to relieve some of that burden on FDA and hopefully result in reviews that are faster but equally robust. What this bill does is to streamline that process and identify ways in which that process can be used for more products. And one of the benefits I think that the sponsors want from the bill is therefore to free up FDA resources for activities that are higher risk or require greater FDA involvement.
Well, that's a very interesting program. I think that and correct me if I'm wrong here, but in effect, you're putting the agency in the position of verifying the data that's presented to them by the outside auditor rather than doing it itself. But I mean, they're still checking the data and making sure that it's correct. But it puts them in a position of being a verifier of the package and of the process in that package, but freeing them up from having to do the review themselves. Is that a fair summary?
That's very fair. And you're absolutely correct that the ultimate decision remains FDA.
Now, is there any potential, and I think you and I talked about this a little offline, is there any impact on the FDA's user fee program from this?
That's an open question right now. As of today, the products that go through the third-party review process do not pay user fees. We will see what the user fee negotiations yield on this point. But user fees for a 510K as of now are approximately $4,000, so we're not talking about a huge amount of money.
So there's no reason that the FDA would feel like it was losing funding for existing, say, staff by expanding or improving this process?
It's not a huge sum of money. I think the more important issues from my perspective are to ensure that we have timely, predictable reviews conducted with the agency maintaining their ultimate decision-making authority.
Terrific. Well, let's close on that note, and we'll join Ralph Hall with us next week to talk more about medical device regulation at the FDA. Thank you very much for coming this week, Ralph.
Thank you.